talking about the Malayans.
Yes. As I say, most of the people that were predominant were in fact the Chinese, unless you went up country. Now, we used to play the Chinese at various sports, actually, please, things like rugby and football. But never the Malays. The Malays were very much laid back. They'd had a reasonably easy war, and they'd just the whole of the war sort of flown off their backs like water off a duck's back. And they still had their traditional way of life, virtually. So they were rather more difficult to get to know at ground level. But as I say, we did get to know the Sultan of Negus Sembilan, and of course the Sultan of Johor Bahru, where we were when we were in the Majidi barracks. He gave his palace to us to use as an officers' mess, officers' club. And it was absolutely magnificent. You could actually live there as well. You know, you could go and spend 2 or 3 days holiday, and there were sunken baths. Oh, it was absolutely fantastic. And the food was fabulous. But they were the only real contact. But the Chinese, we got, we had Chinese cooks, Chinese helpers. And we used to be invited, as I say, to Chinese meals and that sort of thing. And they were the ones that we came in contact with most. One admired them because they were the ones that did most of the resistance during the war. They were largely part of Force 136, which the Malayans weren't.
To come back to the battalion again, you've mentioned officers' mess. Can you tell me how an officers' mess was organised and run? Or the DLI officers' mess in this case?
Yes. In the case of Johor Bahru, the officers themselves had their own quarters. They were little bungalows, and the officers' mess itself was a building in which we foregathered in the evening for drinks, or at lunchtime for drinks, and where we ate all our meals and entertained. It was run by the PMC, President of the Mess Committee, and a committee. It was entirely self-supporting. We did get rations, our own rations, which were delivered to us, but any extras we had to pay for ourselves out of whatever we made from mess subscriptions. We had our own cook and servants, which we dressed however we wanted to have them dressed, usually in a sort of dhoti with a fez or hat of some sort. And all our entertainment was done in that house, in that building. We ran it ourselves.
And the mess charges, were they onerous? Were they pretty high? Mess subscription, rather.
Mess subscriptions, charges, although he said sergeant. We used to have a mess sergeant, yes, he used to. Subscriptions, no, they were geared again. It was proportional ratio. One for a subaltern, two for two pips, a number of pips. One share for each pip. So the colonel had the biggest, he paid the biggest subscription, yes. And how they determined the shares? I think it largely depended on expenditure. If you spent so much, then you split the shares into the number of shares that were available, and each person coughed up.
Was there a set pattern of behaviour? I'm thinking dining and order of precedence and so forth.
That's right, yes, there was. But post-war, it wasn't as sticky as it was later on. On a dinner night, we had very rarely had dinner nights just after the war. But when there was a dinner night, then you had to be in the mess by a certain time, and you had to be dressed in mess kit, which then was just a clean pair of olive greens, really, you know. We just lived in and worked in olive greens. The CO would be, the PMC was the most important chap, and the deputy would be at both one end of the table. The CO would probably be in the middle, and then others distributed around about. Not in any particular order of seniority or anything like that. But you'd usually find that the senior bloke would sit next to the CO because they probably knew each other better. And you'd find that the subalterns were further down the table. And if it was a dinner night, then there would be formal. We'd say grace, the party would say grace, and then we'd eat and be served for service, and we'd have the silver out. And then right at the end, there would be the toast, which we used to give them sitting down, because that was a privilege that was granted us. The port was then passed down, and we would stay talking, and then after a while, we'd get up and go and have coffee in the lounge. But other than that, the normal night, we just go in and have a drink. When you're ready, go and have a meal. Bring a meal, have it, go back out. There was some pretty heavy drinking in those days. In fact, there was very heavy drinking. You know, you usually finished up, go to bed, sloshed. Sort of activities we used to get up to were the result of being slightly under the weather anyway. We didn't make the mess up, but we used to, be fairly rowdy.
Come back to your own duties. What were the duties and responsibilities of a platoon commander?
Well, your men, first of all, I'd keep them trained.
How many men
30.
Would they have?
30.
And they would be subdivided, would they?
Yes, they were divided into sections. A section was usually 9 blokes. That was Bren, two groups of 3, plus a section IC and a Bren group. And then your platoon would consist of yourself and a runner and a signaller. When we first landed in Singapore, we went up to the Chinese High School and later to Johor Bahru, we were responsible for guarding arms depots, which was necessary because the Chinese were stealing the weapons and the arms for their later activities. And there was continual outgoing by pilfering. So we were detailed. I remember being detailed with my platoon to guard a place, and I took it seriously. Yeah, I thought, well, if we're supposed to be guarding it, we might as well do it properly. So I dug positions, brain guns and position, and we defended the place, you know. And I remember the company commander coming along one day to inspect us, and I said, fire away, fire a few rounds over his head. He nearly jumped out of his skin because he'd been in the Pacific, you know. He wasn't long gone from the war. And he didn't bug me, but he got a bit peeved about it. I said, well, I'm supposed to be doing that. I'll just give you a demonstration. Anyway, and that virtually was our main task while we were there. When we went up to Kuala Pila, Farrembun, up country, we had company detachments out. And A company were out in a place called Kuala Pila, and it was largely a question of showing the flag out of a presence. There was a bit of unrest, largely Chinese, and there was, of course, they were still stealing weapons, and they didn't like the planters, because the planters had all started to come back anyway. The social round was quite hectic, because the planters were always asking about, and they were showing us around their plantations and that sort of thing. Sports, we used to play the Chinese a lot of sports, and they were very good, mostly football. Not much hockey played, but mostly football.
These were pre-emergency times, were they?
Yes.
And the communist movement
emergency was, yes, Chinese communists, who in fact were the mainstays of the Force 136.
So they were quite experienced.
Oh yes.
Fighters,
oh yes.
Right?
Oh yeah. Yes. They knew what they were doing, and of course they knew they could. We weren't taking it really seriously enough, you know, the fact that they were after the weapons. Because I don't think we really appreciated that. We didn't, anyway, appreciate what they were going to do with them. I think it might have been known higher up that they were collecting weapons for a bit of mayhem later on, which indeed they did in Belgium. They started, I think, in 1948.
Do you recall any particular time when you were involved with pilfering yourself, and you mean the sense of
catching a Chinaman. No, catch him and do it. No? No, I can't remember. I don't think even my platoon did. No.
Any names in your patrol, in your platoon that you recall? Any particular characters, personalities?
I can recall characters, but I can't recall names. I'm trying to set up. I was platoon commander when we were in Chinese high school, and somewhere along the line I was sent to Kluang where I became Mortar Officer. And I was Mortar Officer then until we came. And then I took over the company. I can't remember what we used to give demonstrations with the mortars, and I used to take them out for training, 3-inch mortars. And we had a lot of what they call misfires. They were pre-ignition. They were the secondary, the barrels used to get hot, the secondary charges would burn on the way down, and they wouldn't come over the barrel properly, or if they did, they used to just lob out. Normally, they didn't go off. But with the bombs that we had, I think they were pretty old bombs, and they were blowing up in front of the position. We had a couple of blokes who were wounded with shrapnel from one of these bombs that had gone off. On another occasion, I was coming back from the firing, and the carrier that we were in, that I was in, caught fire because there were still secondary charges in the back, and they'd got onto an exhaust or something, and it caught fire, and the flames were coming through the engine cowling, and the driver, without bothering to do anything about stopping, he just hopped out of the carrier, and he broke his leg actually. And I turned around to tell him to stop, and he'd gone. So I managed to stop him by pulling the wheel around until it did stop. By which time, the blokes behind me had come up and said, "Well, what's the matter? Oh, look, it's on fire. I said, "Well, good, do something about it for goodness sake." Well, so they did, they put it. And he said, "You've left the engine running, you know." I can't even remember the name of my sergeant at that time. He was quite a canny bloke, actually. No, I can't remember. That's a long time ago.
How was the mortar platoon constituted? How was it made up?
There were three sections, if I remember right. There were three mortars, and each with a section. And it was made up with each section had a carrier, in which they carried the bomb and the mortar, the bombs, and the crew. The crews consisted of three blokes, an aimer, a layer, and a bomb. A bomb, the chap who put the bombs down the barrel. I mean, even the terminology is not very military, is it? And then there was my headquarters, which consists of a runner, a signaller, and myself, and my batman.
Who was your batman?
I had a bloke called Craddock once. That was, where the hell were we then? We were in, I think it was while I was in Kluang, I think. I remember him because he pinched my trousers. My father had a very smart light corduroy uniform made, and my mother had given it to me, and I'd had it tailored to fit. And he pinched the trousers to them. And I didn't know anything about it until he'd gone, the Timex, and he'd gone home. I remember his name because of that. Other than that, I can't remember any other batman that I had.
But the relationship between officer and batman should hopefully be a good one.
Usually. I remember the chap I had in Korea he'd come in the morning, he didn't want to do it, he'd come in the morning and say, "There's your tea." "You want out else?" Yeah, but it was good friendly. I met him afterwards when I was recruiting in Durham, and he came and had a chat. Tubby Hall, I'll always remember him.
3-inch mortars, I think you said.
Yes.
And as a weapon, what were they like? I mean, all right, you had problems with your bombs, but as a weapon,
well, the thing, I never really, we used to have strange accesses. I was mortar officer in Germany. After we left the 2nd Battalion broke up, I joined the 1st Battalion, and I was sent to Netheravon on a mortar course. That's the first time I've been on a course at all. And a proper course. And when we went to Germany, they were fantastic. Really was they were really fantastic. I remember one day Mike Handler coming up, and I was showing them what you could do with more of the soldiers. And we had them up on a brow of a hill, aiming at a hill in the distance. And I said to one of the corporals, Hanford, I think his name was, I said, they were doing a little practice. I said, see that little bush on the far hill? Yes. I said, see what you can do with that. So he gave his orders, and the bombs were falling all over the place. And Mike Hanford said to me, you do it. So I gave a collection, two collections, up and right, I think it was. And the bush. And he looked at me and he said, you lucky man. It was like, but that was, they were good there. And we used to go on battalion exercises at places like Vogelsang and put down smoke, which he used to say, you know, it's absolutely marvellous. He said, so much so that he was the one that got me back on the town to go to Korea, because he told Peter Jeffrey that I was one of the finest mortar officers that ever lived, you know. But in the days in the lair, I don't know whether it's got anything to do with the atmospherics or not, they weren't very accurate. The carriers were a nuisance. They were the old wheeled carriers. Later on, we got them with the two sticks. And it was very difficult to operate them with the wheels, the driving wheel. You could never really get a good stunk with them. And I found that eventually when I got to Korea as well. Yes, it was.
Could they be fired from the carrier?
No. Carriers weren't reinforced to take them. No.
So in Malay, you've arrived, you've got settled in, and
well, we got settled into the lady, the Chinese girl high school.
And your role was ultimately just to keep protecting arms.
Yes.
And did that continue for any length of time?
Yes, it continued most of the time that we were down in the Singapore area, Johor Bahru and Singapore area. Yes, when we went up to Surrenden, it was more showing the flag, I suppose, more than anything. Trying to keep the peace, whatever it might affect or might be necessary.
Nothing really outstanding that occurred to you?
No. There's nothing lethal, anyway.
Were you still a second lieutenant at this time?
When did I become after? I was lieutenant. When we went up to, when I went up to Sulaiman, I had two picks. I must have got it, I think you got it after 6 months, I think it was, from commissioning. And I remember one night I was due to have it, but they hadn't put it in orders. So I put it up anyway. And the girls that we were associating with at that time, I took them at the officers' club. And the first chap I bumped into was the adjutant. He said, what are you wearing those things for? So in front of my girlfriend, I'd take one of them off. And the next day it was in orders. Sam Small, that was the adjutant's name. I'm trying to think of Finlater. Finlater was the CO at that time. He was from an Irish regiment, I think. That was the other trouble, you know. We didn't really have all that number of Geordies. The junior officers were quite a lot of Geordies amongst them, and they remained friends. I still have two or three of them, you know, I meet from time to time. In fact, we go to there's a two DLI reunion in South Shields every year, and just the Saturday nearest to Hooge Day, and the five of us go. We did have, as I was saying earlier, we did have a lot of trouble when we were up at Kuala Pila, Surrenden, with the Gunner people who objected to being there at all. You know, they'd, as far as they were concerned, they'd had their war. I suppose they were quite. objected strongly to being kept in long enough, or longer than was really necessary. And I remember one night, you know, they literally refused to do anything. And the company commander was completely flummoxed. Didn't know what to do. And neither did I. Eventually, they sort of, fortunately, they decided, okay, we'll let it go this time, but we want to get over as soon as possible. So, that, you know, eventually they did go, of course. And at that time, I think it was the parachute regiment. They at a place called Malacca, they had mutinied on as a battalion, refused to do anything. The RAF, they were having the same similar problems down at Salita in Malaya and at Changi.
And these are men who'd been out a long time.
They were men who'd been in the war and felt that they shouldn't be any longer in the services, that they should be home. Certainly not in Malaya, you know. If we were going to have to stay a bit longer, we wanted to be somewhere a little bit more comfortable. It wasn't one of the nicest places in the world to be, because the climate was very bad, especially Singapore. Not really, no. We never really got properly settled. It was a complete state of flux altogether. Even when we eventually went from Malaya up to Burma, back to Burma, and we went to a place called Maimio, which was a lovely station. It was a beautiful station, up a hill station up above Mandalay. Even there, they weren't happy. You know, it was fragmented, and it was people were coming and going all the time. Including the officers. I was a company commander. I spent the whole of my I was proud of the fact that I was able to name everybody in my company, because the others couldn't, you know. And it was only by dint of the fact that I was writing them down with shout practically every day, you know. And it didn't necessarily mean that I could put a face to a name, but I could name everybody. And when we left to come home, I was in fact one of the company commanders, and That was my big achievement, that I knew the name of everybody in my company. There was only about 80 of them as well, you know, what should have been something like 100 and something, 160.
Did you have problems with BD amongst the battalion?
Yes.
BD?
Oh, yes. But I mean, some of the Brussels that they used to read, one of the duties of the ordinary officer was to go down to the Brussels, you know. It's one of the most amusing sights. Bloke having a go with their hat still on, you know, and boots and everything else. And you'd go in and as a duty officer, and the chap in charge of it would have all the girls lined up for you, you know, and you were supposed to pick one of them. And it was took quite a bit of persuading to get it across to them that we were on duty. yes, there was a canny bit of VD, fairly rife. Somebody. That was the other thing, you know, people being sick, absent on sick or courses. We were never at full strength, never. Even when in Burma we were chasing dacoits, it was seldom that, never, that a company was at full strength.
Was it a discipline situation if they got BD in the battalion? Were they in trouble if they caught BD? The men? Was that a disciplinary offence?
Oh, yes, that was conduct of the prejudice for not taking necessary precautions. They were supposed to take a condom out of the guard room before they went out and use it. And if they caught BD, they obviously didn't, so they were charged with conduct prejudicial. Yes. And they were doing that when we were in Berlin in 1964.
And what might happen to them? Did they confine the barracks, or what punishment would they give them?
Well, it would be junkers, yes. Or
they'd have a medical situation.
Yes.
And was the pay stopped as it used to be at one time?
The CO could if he wanted to, yeah. Pay often did, yeah. If that was the way it hurt. Junkers, I suppose, wasn't all that bad, but certainly if they were short of cash.
Have any of the memories of Malaya before we move on?
One of my favourite occasions was I became very friendly with a chap called Pincher Martin, who was one of the local planters, and he used to invite us out to lunch every Sunday, and we always had either a marmi or a bihun. And the difference between the two is that a marmi has got thin pasta, and a bihun has thick pasta. It used to come in as a mountain of stuff like that, and we would have beer and this. And it was always produced by a little girl who was the was his mistress. They all had their own mistresses, but they used to treat them very well, and they made sure that they had something to fall back on when either he died or went back home. This little girl was particularly attractive. But anyway, it was the pleasant part of going out having a meal, and the type of food that was very, very nice indeed. I've never had it since, actually. I tried it once in a Chinese restaurant, I didn't know what I was talking about. Other than that, I remember the sports. Kuala Lumpur was a very fascinating place. The station, I think, is still the same now as it used to be when we were there, an old Victorian type building. The athletics, we used to play, the brigade had the brigade athletics, and then there were divisional athletics being held at in Kuala Lumpur. And I remember winning the long jump and the 100 yards and the 220 yards for both brigade and the 440 yards. I won that. That was a sprint, and I didn't realise it until I saw it being done by professionals. I used to run hard and then take it easy for about 200 metres and run like hell for the last few hundred, or the last 100. Other than that, no. I went on a leave once to the Cameron Highland, which I found very, very pleasant. I wasn't playing golf in those days, but there was a very, very good challenging golf course just below the hotel. We stayed in the hotel in the Cameron Highlands, which had been occupied by the Japanese hierarchy, you know, the generals and things. Their signatures were still there. And that was quite a pleasant interview, actually. I enjoyed that.
In Malaya,
well, we were there for about a year, I think, at first. Then we went up to Burma, and we were there for about 8 or 9 months. Then we came back to Malaya, and from there we were there for about another 3 months. And in 1947, I think it was, or yes, early 47, we came back to England with a Carter, with a view to being disbanded. And we went to a place called Bicester.
So the next stage for you is into Burma?
The next stage from there was up to Burma, yes, when we went. I went on LIAP from Mujidi Barracks. And by the time I came back, which was 3 months later, because I had LIAP, Sulrom. Sulrom being special end of war leave for regular officers and men. Which I got tagged onto my LIAP, which was leave in advance of Python. Python being their time expired for 3 years. By the time I got back, they were in Burma,